Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community. I'll be speaking with our regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is Friday, June 17, 2011. I didn't know whether I should announce it's my 38th wedding anniversary. Well, thank you to all of our listeners. We have reached so many thousands of listens on our show. We have a variety of shows, and our regular Thursday was switched to Friday due to scheduling, and we're going to be talking about very, very important issues that test our thinking, that really maybe things that we don't want to believe are actually happening in this world, and we have to be discerning as to what is truth and what is not truth, because some people in important and high-level places are listening to our show. Actually, I do believe that is true. In addition to the guy and gal in the street who also tune in to find out what's happening behind the closed doors, and whoever wants to put a listening ear into our show, we're going to be talking about healthcare fraud and getting it personal, and we're talking about who's to blame and taking on consequences to criminal actions. There are no more corporate negotiations and legal maneuvering. You won't want to miss what we're going to talk about today. We might be all over the place because Alan has lined up lots of different issues. Alan is an attorney at law in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He's a leading nation's vaccine rights attorney and advises individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights. He supports legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice and has written so many wonderful articles, white papers, and talked to our legislators. He has published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters and appears regularly at the rallies and conferences that you like to attend. He's on the radio and on television and is also now a regular columnist on Natural News with Mike Adams. He is really out there. I don't know how he has time for all of this, but I'm not going to mention something else, but Alan, you're there, huh?
I am. Well, I sleep twice a week, whether I need it or not. So
both you and I are up very late doing all of this investigative work and writing and getting people to become aware of what's happening in our world.
Well, most people who follow a traditional lifestyle, at least in terms of schedule, 40-hour work weeks and the like, especially those who do that and have families, don't have time to do this, Debbie. Somebody has to do it. So you and I are, I think, both teetering on the boundary there in terms of getting enough sleep sometimes. But this is a critical work, and I'm delighted and blessed to be able to share this with you every Thursday.
Well, we kind of live on the edge, don't we?
In more than one way, but we'll save that for another time. A lot going on in the news, as always, Debbie, and this week, as you alluded to, I want to break a little bit away from the specific focus on vaccines.
Sorry about that. Hold on. I just had that website flare up there, so go ahead.
I wanted to veer a little bit away from the our typical focus, which is specifically vaccines and vaccine rights, to the context in which that sits, a little bit broader, healthcare in general, and kicking things off here, saw an article in the Huffington Post recently, which is claiming that the federal government is now going to be targeting top executives in the pharmaceutical industry for health fraud. And the bottom line is, according to this article, and this certainly is consistent with my own research apart from this article, is that it appears that the pharmaceutical industry regularly engages in criminal behavior, and I'd love to elaborate on that briefly. But even the World Health Organization in late 2009 reported that corruption in the pharmaceutical sector, as they call it, occurs throughout all stages of the medicines chain, referring to everything from research and development to dispensing and promotion. So this is not some conspiracy theory from outside of nowhere. This is something that goes on. And let me give you some more specific examples. In 2008, Merck was fined $650 million under the Federal False Claims Act. In 2009, Pfizer was assessed a $1 billion criminal fine, that's billion with a B, along with a $1.3 billion civil fine. One of the reasons that the court issued such a high criminal fine, I've not heard of one as high or higher than that in any single instance against a pharmaceutical company. I think that's a top end so far. But it was the fourth settlement. It was actually a settlement. It was the fourth settlement since 2002 for Pfizer over illegal marketing. And so the numbers just keep going up. In 2009 also, Eli Lilly was assessed a $515 million criminal fine along with a $900 million civil fine. Just last year, 2010, GlaxoSmithKline was assessed a $150 million criminal fine and a $750 million civil fine. These are enormous numbers, and yet many would say that in terms of the large pharmaceutical corporations' overall sales, that these numbers really aren't as large as they might sound to us as individuals. But the bottom line here is that this kind of behavior has gone on for many, many, many years. It's gotten much worse in the last 5 or 6 years, and they keep repeating the same behavior. It's not limited to just one or two or three different companies. I have a list here in a previous article of, I don't know, a dozen or more different companies, and the average over the last 20 years has been close to $1 billion a year in fines, and yet the behavior not only continues, it continues to get worse. The only reasonable conclusion we can draw from this kind of behavior, these kinds of events, is that it is profitable for the pharmaceutical industry to engage in criminal behavior. Why else would they keep doing it? Why would so many companies be doing it? Why would they be doing it despite fines in the hundreds of millions of dollars in many instances? So it must be profitable to do. So it makes perfect sense to me, as this article seems to suggest from the Huffington Post, that the feds are saying what we've been doing so far isn't working. It's not stopping the behavior. It's not curbing the behavior. The behavior is getting worse, if anything. And as a side note, I think it's really important to note that when any individual, whether we're talking about a person or a company or a corporation, engages in criminal behavior or other wrongful behavior and gets caught, that doesn't tell us how many times they did behavior that they didn't get caught. This is one of my, and I don't want to get too far afield here, this is one of my big complaints about mainstream media's representation of improper or corrupt behavior of politicians, is that it seems to be treated more or less like, oh, here's this one bad apple in the barrel, as opposed to, oh, here's the one who slipped up and got caught. You know, we don't know how many other politicians are also engaging in similar or even potentially worse behavior, but they were just smart enough to do it in a way that that they didn't get caught. But in any case,
this is a theme that you've mentioned numerous times. And so there seems to be the winds are changing in some way because enough people are listening to that type of tune to realize we do need to change. And I would like to know, who is at the source of making these changes in terms of paying the price of these criminal behaviors? Who is the one who's now targeting the upper level CEOs of these companies?
Well, this would be federal enforcers, because the pharmaceutical industry in recent years has become the largest defrauder of the federal government. And this happens, among other ways, in times and places with Medicare and Medicaid. And as the Huffington Post article points out, by some estimates, healthcare fraud costs taxpayers $60 billion a year. And in the language of the article, quoting it here, galling when Medicare faces insolvency. It seems to me to be just this extreme version of, I can reach the cookie jar, so I'm going to grab for the cookies, regardless of the impact that it has on other, you know, on people's lives, which, of course, is particularly disturbing in the healthcare industry. Surely corruption occurs in other industries, but without the sort of direct effect on people's lives and health as it does when it occurs in the healthcare industry. So it's just particularly disturbing when you see such complete lack of ethics and morality. It seems, of course, we can really ultimately, I guess, only speculate, but I don't think this is out of left field. It seems that it must be driven by a bottom line dollars and cents numbers kind of position. You know, I can easily imagine if you throw out any ethics and morality, if you completely suppress your heart or disconnect your heart from your head and simply look at the numbers, well, we're going to get caught on average this many times. We're going to be fined, based on the history, probably this amount. We're still going to come away with a net profit of this. Let's do it. I'm not in those rooms where the decisions are made, but it must go something like that in essence. Or why would we see the same behavior? Why would we see, you know, the rising cost? So
seems like we kind of are seeing, in a way, a split of two extremes of, you know, tree huggers and really people who are out for preserving the earth and protecting the environment and protecting our health. And then on the other extreme, there's these people who are doing criminal behavior. And I've heard a lot of the phrase harden their heart, which you alluded to there with disconnect their heart from their head. And this may be the clash of what's going on when there is a major change going to be happening. And I really wish that Greg Glaser was here today on our show, because I feel as if this kind of legal confrontation is what's going to happen, is it's going to deal with constitutional law once the corporate lawyers start to have their say and try to twist things around. So how can you kind of get into that Huffington Post article a little bit and tell us how you think it's going to play out?
Well, that's a really good question, and let's raise some of these questions with Greg next time he's on. He'll be on, as he is always, the first Thursday of the month, and I would love to have his insight and input on this as well, Debbie, because I'm sure it would be enlightening to both of us and our listeners. But it's really interesting here, because what the feds are now proposing to do, according to this article, is something that is not entirely clear that they can pull off. And, of course, it will meet the strongest possible resistance from those who would be targeted or subject to prosecution. But what it amounts to is that on top of the fines that they've already been paying is that senior executives may now face criminal charges even if they weren't involved in the scheme but could have stopped it had they known. Now, that's pretty sweeping language. You know, criminal law, at least, I mean, there are exceptions everywhere in law, but as a starting point, criminal law requires, and successful criminal prosecution requires, that particular elements of a crime be shown and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And traditionally in criminal law, that includes what's called mens rea, or criminal mind. That is, you had to have the criminal intent. You know, you can't accidentally hold up a bank with a gun. You know, you have
well,
to really
intend
to do
that.
Well, you know,
wouldn't these people question what's going on? They're not blind, deaf, and dumb to news, to controversy, to what is happening, to what the other people are saying, and they should be investigating and questioning what's happening in their own firm and organization. They are looking at the bottom line. They're looking at the numbers. They should be questioning for themselves how the numbers are getting there. I mean, it's not that they can not know. They have to know. And if they're at the top, they're responsible.
They're responsible, but these are large corporations, and it's easy to see, for me to see, how a top executive would not have direct first-hand information about potentially fraudulent activities going on that is really being overseen directly by someone lower down in the hierarchy in the corporate structure. But I think and of course that's the argument they're going to make. Well, I didn't know that was going on. That was such and such in a different department or whatever. And so therein, I think, lies the difficulty in these kind of prosecutions. That's going to be difficult to, potentially anyway, to convince a jury that the top executive did know or should have known. Because I think what they're saying here, they're taking this, it's a little bit of a stretch on the more simplistic conventional criminal concept of criminal law, in the sense that someone had to do something deliberately, know it was wrong when they were doing it, know that it was a criminal violation when they did it, or wrong when they did it, and they did it anyway. And
well,
that's what happens.
Let me ask you this. If the company had been fined more than once, there's no doubt in my mind that everybody in the entire company should have known. It's not
you make a really good point there, Debbie, and I don't have any, you know, I play devil's advocate. Of course, you and I are on the same side of these alternative health issues, but I play devil's advocate perhaps as a byproduct of my personality and legal training both, but I don't have a response to that one. If the company has ever been fined a significant amount of money,
yes,
if the same behavior comes up again,
yes,
I think the senior executives absolutely are responsible, unless, okay, this is the best I can do, Debbie, playing devil's advocate here again, unless they can show some ongoing proactive effort on their part to seek out and know what's going on, and somehow show that despite implementing reasonable measures to keep track of everything, that somebody else, some other bad apple in the somewhere down in the corporate structure,
uh-huh,
managed to somehow evade all of that and convince everybody things were good so that he or she could continue that behavior or repeat,
uh-huh,
that behavior or other inappropriate behavior. But you're right there. Once you've been called to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in particular, although I wouldn't think there would be any minimum threshold, you know, it could be $50,000.
And even if it happened to a different company of the same nature, another pharmaceutical company, you have to turn around and look at yourself. You know,
well, that's a real good point, too. At this point in time, you're winning me over, Debbie. At this point in time,
I should have been a lawyer.
Well, maybe so. At this point in time, there have been so many companies that have been hit with so many enormous fines, and surely that sort of information travels like wildfire throughout the industry. You could not reasonably be a pharmaceutical executive and not know the information that I just, you know, rattled off, although in much greater detail, because you're going to be saying, how do we avoid that? Even if, worst case scenario, you're thinking, oh, we got to figure out how to not get caught when we do it, as opposed to we got to make sure that doesn't happen. But even if they were consciously, deliberately evil, saying, well, we're going to maximize profits, we just have to make sure we cover this up even better, you know they know about it, is my point. So, and that was your point, and a very good one, and I'm less and less inclined to cut these people slack the further we take this discussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will be looking forward to hearing what plays out in the courts when they start this prosecution and the further investigation, because, you know, just like, I don't want to name the recent New York person who is in the news too much, You know, at first a person is frightened. They're scared. They're protecting themselves. They're protecting their family. And they lie just to cover up and not realizing eventually the truth will come out. And then when the truth comes out, it's all obvious. And so in the same way, I can understand how the individuals who are in the pharmaceutical companies at the high levels are scared. And they do it. Once you make one lie, it's, you know, there's this thing that you start to turn more and more lies and you get caught up in it and you don't know how to get out. So humanly, you know, our human nature falls into this type of a pattern. And I can understand it, but somehow you have to be ethical and you have to give it, you know.
You need to find some way to fall out of the pattern.
Yeah, you have to find some way to just express yourself and tell the truth and to yourself and to your family and to the other people and pay the consequences. So we're going to see what happens. So do you want to go ahead to the next issue that you had on the agenda or more?
Sure. Let me just make a couple more comments here because I know we had a lot we wanted to cover and time rolls by quickly on this show. But there is a test case playing out right now with an 83-year-old drug company chief executive, a fellow by the name of Howard Solomon with Forest Laboratories in New York City. So we have an opportunity to see how this goes. I think it's going to be difficult, but if this is truly a shift in, and some of this has to do with just enforcing laws that have already been on the books, if the federal government follows through with this, and we have the Inspector General's Office at Health and Human Services, and also the Justice Department and the Food and Drug Administration, apparently all three of these entities started moving more or less independently toward holding executives accountable. So if they really adhere to that, if they really follow through with that, if there are some people there with the correct combination of personal and legal resources they need, these are going to be some very interesting times in coming months because this is a problem that's rampant in the pharmaceutical industry, in my opinion, and from what I've seen.
So this is already in the works.
There's already a test case. I expect that regardless of the outcome of this individual case, that there will be other cases. But now if it turns out that it's difficult or impossible to successfully prosecute these folks, that will be devastating news, in my opinion, because that would mean they can continue treating this all purely as a numbers game. That is, they can handle so many fines and they can do so much illegal activity and come out with a net profit. I mean, it sounds more like a mafia kind of operation than it does a legitimate business operation. But we'll have to see. But if they're successful in prosecuting one or two of these top executives, just the threat of it is already sending chills around the industry, I expect. And if they are successful on one or more occasions over the near future, I think that has the potential to have a powerful and positive change in the industry. But we'll see. We'll certainly report later as we have more information about this.
Okay. So the next thing that you had lined up was an investigation into clinical drug trials that are happening abroad.
This was something that comes to us from
PBS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a need to know, is what they call it, program. And there was a couple of investigative journalists. Now, these are a gentleman by the name of James Steele and Donald Bartlett. They are both Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalists. They have a combined reporting of over 90 years. There's some older gentlemen quite familiar with investigative journalism would be perhaps an understatement here. But they have looked into this phenomenon that has been increasing over recent years, and that is that pharmaceutical industry is more and more so taking research overseas to do their clinical drug trials. And there are some serious problems associated with this. Now, first of all, these guys have said, now this it was a very short article, and then a YouTube video interviewing these guys talking about what they found here, about a 10-minute win. And by the way, all the articles we're talking about here are linked on the news page of the Pandemic Response Project website, and that is pandemicresponseproject.com. pandemicresponseproject.com. There's a news link on the top right, and you can see these and many, many other articles, mostly pertaining to vaccines, but occasionally to related issues such as corruption or conflicts of interest in the broader healthcare arena, which is what we're talking about today. So what we've seen increasingly, I mean, it's always gone on to one degree or another, according to these folks, but an increasing globalization of drug testing and the drug testing industry. Over the last 15 to 20 years, the overseas trials have exploded, was the word that these guys used, around the world. And so, of course, the question is, why should we be concerned about foreign drug trials? Well, when you do drug trials overseas, that is outside of the jurisdiction of any United States federal or state agency. Some of these overseas trials can get FDA approval when U.S. trials can't or don't get approval. And we've had situations where we've had a lot of drugs that were approved.
Can I comment on this?
Absolutely.
I think it kind of goes both ways, because sometimes in other countries, they're more lenient and accepting of alternative methods of healing. And we don't accept that when certain trials or certain ways of using herbs or other medications or other drugs actually do work. The USA is staunchly against allowing that. So I think it kind of runs both ways.
It can, and I'll just mention real briefly, I don't know if you've seen this or not, Debbie, I just today saw an article that compared about a study comparing homeopathy with conventional cancer treatments and found homeopathy came out on top.
What was that at?
I'll have to send you the link.
Okay.
I don't have
conventional
the details
cancer up. Treatments. Yeah.
Conventional compared to homeopathy, and I thought that was, you know, not
okay.
real surprising to me. I'm a fan of homeopathy, but always delighted to see when there is some information that supports or endorses the alternative treatments, because I feel like there's so much confusion and corruption and lack of clarity in the orthodox medical arena that it's really hard to know what you can rely on or not. And that's what we're getting to in beneath the hood on that a little bit today. But here was an example that they gave in the YouTube video from Misters Steele and Bartlett, that they were talking about one drug in particular, Ketek, which is Ketek, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's
how
an
do you
antibiotic.
Spell it?
K-E-T-E-K.
Okay.
It's an antibiotic that's used for respiratory tract infections. They found when they investigated this that there was fabricated data on at least 91% of study participants. But these overseas trials can – see, there's much less oversight by either the countries where these trials are done or by the FDA being a U.S. agency, can't go overseas and
right. We can't oversee what's going on over there.
Right. Of course, there's some pretty significant evidence, pretty clear and significant evidence to show that the FDA is not an agency that, unfortunately, that we can rely on to consistently and properly do its job. In fact, I just saw another video where a whistleblower who worked for the FDA was reporting that his boss in the FDA told him that their client was the pharmaceutical industry. And
yes.
He argued,
no,
it's not the industry. He says, no, your client, talking to his employee, medical doctor, researcher, telling him that, no, your client is the industry. You know, that sort of thing is probably the practical reality, but it's certainly not what the FDA is supposed to be doing. And so, you know, how much do we lose by not having the FDA oversee, you know, foreign drug trials? We could split hairs on that point, I suppose. But the point is that if the FDA is going to have the opportunity to do its job properly at all, it's going to have some access, and it doesn't have that when these are overseas, or at least not at all the kind of access that they would to trials conducted here in the U.S.
Well, yeah, the problem being that the FDA is not a totally objective entity. And Dr. Bob has written that if pharma funds over 90% of the clinical trials, why should we expect that the results be anything favorable for their company when they're the ones who are trying to sell their drug and they're doing their own research? So that's what you've always talked about.
And so
we're not going to see much in terms of FDA oversight being perfectly a clear line. You know, we're here and we're really to protect the people and their health because we're getting paid off in some way.
There's clear evidence of bias. I don't for a second think that everybody who works for the FDA is evil or conflicted or what have you, and we've talked about this before too. The Union of Concerned Scientists report on federal agency scientists, they did a survey and found a lot of scientists were a significant percentage of the time and across the board in federal agencies were frustrated that their research was either being suppressed or policy enacted contrary to their research, or they were told to change something in their research because their boss didn't like the results. So there are a lot of people out there trying to do the right thing, and there are people in key positions who get to decide whether or not in any given instance to do the right thing. So I'm sure that the federal agencies work correctly sometimes with regard to some issues, but I'm equally and adamantly clear that we cannot rely on them to consistently do objectively do the job they're supposed to do. There's serious problems there, and I'm not going to get into how we might fix that right now, but
well, that's
or
why
it's
we need
fixable,
these investigative reporters.
That's right,
you know, and there seem to be more of them coming out lately, where we didn't have them as much in the last 5 years, 10 years or so.
You know, I'll mention that one of the guys in this, one of these investigative journalists, said that they could investigate the healthcare industry for the rest of their lives and would never run out of material to investigate. They were just adamant that the problems in this particular arena, in the healthcare industry, are just vast. It's vast. And, you know, we heard that from the WHO. We hear that from anybody reputable who really looks into this and comments on the problems to one degree or another seems to have that same sentiment. But just to kind of wrap up real quickly, that antibiotic Ketek is something produced by Sanofi Aventis, and they had serious problems with large American clinical trials, so they took it overseas, and the drug was approved, the trials overseas, and the drug was approved. They made a couple of $100 million in their first year, but within a few years, the adverse events started showing up and being reported. And the use of the drug was ultimately restricted with changes in labeling. And this is one of the things that I believe they commented on here, is that sometimes the quote-unquote fix to problems when they are discovered is to make a change in the labeling. But does that really take a harmful – I mean, it doesn't take a harmful drug off the market. You know, it probably shouldn't have gotten into the market in the first place, but since it was profitable to manipulate and maneuver through the system in such a way as to be able to get it on the market anyway, then of course, you know, it does, from what I understand, cost millions of dollars to bring a drug to market under current regulations and procedures, required procedures. So it's no wonder that when you're playing a game at that level, you can't even get into the game unless you have millions, if not tens of millions of dollars to get started.
I think very often what they do is they allow the people who are already using it without a problem, supposedly without a problem, to continue to use it, or they, like you say, they change the application. Well, it may not be good for this, but it's good for that, or something to that effect.
Yeah, I'm not real clear on that point. It's if the changes in labeling, it would be that it would add warnings or restrict use from people who would be more inclined to have a more serious adverse event. It's just that, you know, when you've got something that's problematic from the start, it improperly finds its way to market through the very deliberate maneuvering. It probably should never have gotten on the market in the first place had the trials been conducted properly and with transparency and with full disclosure of the actual complete results and so forth.
How does the lawsuits play into it? We've got Fosamax has lawsuits because women have been taking it for a decade and now their bones are simply crumbling under them. And the Avandia lawsuits, once these drugs get into the marketplace and then we have now all these lawsuits going on and settlements, what actually happens to the drug company or to the drug itself in terms of labeling and use? Is it taken off the market?
Well, this again is just part of the cost of doing business, at least up to this point, that whatever happens, there's some adverse effect, and they essentially, as far as I can tell, buy their way out of it. You know, they'll get fined, they'll try to settle suits, and of course they're not happy about losing any money or paying anything, but they wouldn't continue operating in the way that they operate if it weren't profitable to do that. So that's sort of a bottom line principle I think we have to make. Now, as to how far they'll go, when on any given instance, and how much is deliberate or inadvertent, who knows? You know, that's the details are going to vary from specific case to specific case. But, you know, unless we have something of what we were just talking about where the federal prosecutors are going to really step up and be more aggressive about this to see if they can truly bring this under control, and if they can do that, unless they can do that successfully, I don't see, you know, a way to fix the problem. We have to be able to identify and prosecute these problems. But if these two journalists are correct, you know, that's something we could spend a very long time doing before we actually got to everything there was to get to. So,
In that article, it said that even when the pharmaceutical companies are fined, that in the end it is the people who are paying for the drugs who actually pay that cost, because the drug, I guess, they just raise the price on it or in some way. Dr. Bob, who is on the chat, says that it takes between $450 to $900 million to bring a new prescription compound to the market. And my question is, what part does the general public play in this whole scenario? Because it's not just the drug companies and the federal government, but the people who are taking the drugs, that they themselves have to, I think that they are being more skeptical of taking drugs, they are more wary, and yet there are people who feel that they are completely dependent upon them and believe their doctor that this is the right thing for them and this is the only way that they're going to stay alive by taking whether it's 1 to 20 drugs a day. And so what part, I think that the people are going to be the ones to move in the direction of solving this problem.
Well, it's like I refer to from time to time, one of my favorite bumper stickers is one that says, when the people lead, the leaders will follow. I think the long-term solution to the problem of the dominance of the allopathic system because of its fundamental flaws, both in the theory and in the application, is not going to be because we file so many lawsuits, they go out of business, although it's okay with me if certain parts of the industry that really deserve that should do that for the benefit of everyone concerned. But rather that as individual citizens, more and more of us begin making choices, become aware, become informed, and make choices. There's an interesting psychological thing that goes on. There are some people who have information that tells them to do one thing, but they'll continue to do what they've been conditioned to do previously. I saw an article recently that says something to the effect that a majority of people are concerned about vaccines, but they go out and get the vaccines anyway. It's a step in the right direction to be aware and concerned, but sometimes the awareness, at least on an intellectual level, doesn't immediately translate into action. It takes, particularly in something as controversial as vaccines, when you have doctors who will yell and scream at you if you even dare to raise a question about them, it's difficult for people to follow up, at least initially, many of us anyway, with information, with action. Or, you know, I remember when I first stumbled onto the vaccine controversy, I was in shock for probably a good 6 months or so. I couldn't open my mouth and talk to anybody about it. It was so against my many, many years of conditioning about the wonder and benefit of vaccines. So it's a complicated issue, how we shift from where we are to a healthier, more sane society and policy, and an enormous piece of that is psychological, in my opinion.
Right. I think it sounds very much like peer pressure plus the tipping point. When is enough information and enough people moving to this other place going to get you to step through that door to
yeah.
move into that new place? And that's, I think it's happening in some cases. It, you know, you could think of also what it takes to get a person to stop smoking. They've tried just about everything in terms of putting on the most grotesque images on advertisements, commercials, and packages for cigarettes, and still people smoke because of one reason or another, and there are many psychological, emotional reasons to do that. And we know that taking drugs is a considerable amount emotionally based also. And if you say that you're pressured by an authority figure, meaning your MD, then you're going to take whatever the white coat says as actually truth without them being fully aware, educated about what's going on with those drugs. So, what do you want to say to that?
Yeah, the smoking is a real good analogy. I was thinking the same thing and just wondering to what extent, either literally or at least by analogy, the word addiction might apply. But it's a real good analogy, at the least, that people can have information. Smoking is a great example. I don't know anybody who smokes who doesn't know intellectually that it's bad for them, and yet there are people who can kick their heroin addiction, but they can't give up cigarettes. It's a very profound physical addiction, and I imagine there are mental, emotional aspects as well. I'm not sure that you can say people are addicted in the same sense to reliance on allopathic care. But there's, I think, again, at least as an analogy, that addiction is a real good, has some similarities to this, that people can have information and still not necessarily act on it. And it's going to, you know, what it takes for any person, any given individual,
it's going
to
be their neighbor. They have to be accepted within their family, that their family accepts their choice, that their neighbors are doing the same thing, that their church or religious organization doesn't look at them funny, that they don't want to be an outsider, but they want to be in the group and part of the community. And if they're doing something totally foreign, it's going to be hard for them to stand up. You have to be a very strong-willed, self-confident individual and have a very strong belief in a particular thing that you do. There are a lot of people go into the raw food diets and the vegetarian diets, but still, you know, all of these different things that are changing in our societies are slow. They take time. And so that's why we're here talking about it. I want to also thank Victor, who is on the chat, and he has given us a number of links in a website called www.opensecrets.org, and there are a couple of articles there about the pharmaceutical industry. He says, which says that within the industry, the trade group Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America leads the way on lobbying activity, spending more than $20.2 million last year. I think this was reported in 2007 or 2009, and I assume that 2009. So that means that I'm sure they even spelled more, and or $10,750 an hour that Congress was in session. Only six other companies in all sectors combined spent more on lobbying last year. Three other drug companies spent more than $10 million on lobbying in 2008, and we can name names, Eli Lilly, Pfizer, and Amgen. Two dozen others spent between $1 million and $7 million. So they have a list that you can download of the top 30 pharmaceutical lobbying clients. This is really, you know, money talks, nobody walks, you know, that's what's going on. And they mentioned that revolving door here on this article. So we can put it up. It's called Will $12 Million a Day Convince? So do a Google search for that or use another browser.
And the thing that is so ironic here is that they could convince me for only $10 or $11 million a day. You know, I don't know why they're wasting all that money in the pharmaceutical industry when they could be giving it to me. But anyway, it's interesting, and it leads me to make comments, rather broad sweeping comments, like capitalism doesn't work, and a lot of people get upset when I say that. But I'll just as a side note here. There's one theory that's called progressive utilization theory, which proposes a more ideal societal structure, and it includes elements of capitalism, but it would place a cap on a limit on the amount of wealth that any individual can accumulate. And I think that's a real interesting idea that would retain at least some of the incentive to compete and be innovative that we get out of capitalism without having the overwhelming domination and suppression that occurs with open-ended capitalism, where whoever's the biggest and has the most money can control everything else and everyone else. And so,
right, and make that number high enough that people still feel motivated and have incentive and drive. I mean, I feel in government there should be a cap on definitely lobbying. That is absolutely absurdity that amount of money can be spent on any one thing, and it should be outlawed. That's my own personal opinion.
Well, anything that encourages or contributes to corruption or conflict of interest or lack of transparency or inhibits fundamental fairness should be excluded and prohibited. It's as simple as that. And, of course, spending that kind of money on lobbyists is for the sole purpose of skewing policy and law to the benefit of objectivity and the well-being of constituents, which is what government is supposed to be about in the first place.
Well, on an even debate, on a scale of an even debate, everybody has the same number of points, let's say. And so if the pharmaceutical company is spending that much money, they should donate to the other side to be able to state their side of the whatever the issue is.
What a great concept, Debbie. I like that. You can spend however much you want as long as you contribute the same amount to an opposing camp for them to promote their views. I love it.
I like that, yeah.
I love it. Okay. That would cut down on the overall amount of spending on lobbyists tremendously, and it would enhance and increase objectivity, transparency, fundamental fairness. I love it. I love it. Let's work on that after the show.
Okay. So,
we're running quick, low on time here. Let's get to this one other topic about the article here that refers to Germany's superbug. If that's okay with you,
go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of articles, one of them titled here, Germany's Superbug is Weaponized with Bubonic Plague DNA. And we had there have been many articles, but a couple in particular that I linked from the Pandemic Response Project news site. And they're talking about the E. coli, recent E. coli outbreaks in Europe. And there have been some disturbing reports that are suggesting that analysis of this particular bug, which has been a much more virulent strain than some other prior strains, that the evidence suggests strongly that this is a bioengineered superbug. A couple different articles that I have used that word, superbug. And I'll have to, be right up front and confess I'm not a scientist and don't have a scientist background, but the explanation here I find compelling. and would love to hear some scientists speak in on this, although, of course, some of them have been involved in these articles, so we have at least the beginnings of that. But in particular, one of the arguments here is that these particular this recent strain, E. coli strain, that's been popping up around Europe in several different countries, I believe, is showing resistance to at least 8 different antibiotics. And the argument here is that this could not reasonably happen naturally. There's a specific process. In fact, it's a process by which they develop, that they use when researchers are deliberately trying to develop a biological weapon, that they will expose a culture. This is a simplistic version according to this article, so the actual process is much more complicated, I expect. But the concept is this, that you expose a culture of a particular, in this case a bacterium, E. coli, to penicillin, and some percentage of that culture will survive. And that's the ones that are resistant to penicillin. And then you go through a procedure where you expose that group to tetracycline. And then you'll have some percentage that will survive that, and you take those and expose them to the next one and so forth. You just go down the list of all these different antibiotics. And it's only after going through a process of repeated exposure to each one of these different antibiotics that you end up with a strain that is, in fact, resistant to a particular antibiotic. So to have a bug now that is showing resistance to 8 different antibiotics, the argument is that could not possibly occur any other way than by a laboratory process, lengthy, long-term, detailed technical process of repeated exposure to each of the antibiotics, and to come away with a strain that is resistant. And then there's another article that is saying that the DNA analysis is showing that there are components from bubonic plague DNA also in these recent E. coli bugs. So very disturbing,
right.
You know, the implication here is being obvious that this is something that was put out deliberately. Now, we could speculate about what the goal was, and these articles talk about possible goals, for, you know, reasons for doing that. But it's very disturbing. Of course, Debbie, as you know, there were a lot of different views on the swine flu virus, giving reasons why they thought that one had to have been engineered as well. And the idea that
And MRSA is a very major problem in hospitals and covering countries, you know, transporting it from one country to another. So we have a lot of these superbugs all around, and we're wondering how they are all of a sudden being manufactured. They're not really natural. And a lot of the cause is the antibiotics, antibiotic resistance. And whether they are purposefully being manufactured to be antibiotic resistant, that's a whole other question.
Right, because as this article points out, if you're going to take the position that this was a natural process, then we're in big trouble. If bugs can just sort of spontaneously pop up that are resistant to a long list of antibiotics, that raises some serious questions, you know, about the health, our health collectively. Now, it may be that, of course, this is assuming, this is coming from an allopathic perspective that presumes that antibiotics are necessary and effective generally. And it may be, Debbie, that you as a homeopath would take at least some exception to that. I don't know. I'd be delighted to hear your comment on that. But
antibiotics have an effect. There's no question antibiotics have an immediate effect to alleviate symptoms. That they appear to be permanent, but they're not. They suppress and they reduce the function of the immune system. So they can be effective, and in life-saving conditions, yes, they can be used, but that's not going to, it's going to breed more resistant antibiotics when they're overused.
So would it be fair or accurate, Debbie, if I said that in many, perhaps even most instances where antibiotics are routinely used today, homeopathy or perhaps other so-called alternative approaches might be equally or more effective, but there may be occasional instances where you really do need to intervene at least temporarily with an antibiotic?
Well, each person has their preference. I think that homeopathy can take care of most instances of infection and illness and discomfort. Homeopathy is based upon the symptom picture and not the name of a disease, and is individualized medicine. So yes, it can help. I've many times come across where someone had been given antibiotics for what appeared to be an infection, or they give it because there's going to be an infection, supposedly. You know, they really don't know. And this does not do well for the individual. So then they have received the homeopathic remedy that is specific for what is going on in their situation, in their case. They have been able to stop taking the antibiotics even after 1 or 2 days and not continue on, even though they've been told medically that you're supposed to continue on taking those drugs, and they do get better. So there are so many thousands and thousands of cases that are like this that we have to take it into consideration, and the use of other kinds of alternatives. We've talked in the past show with Phyllis Georgic, a homeopath who has given us many suggestions about what to do in terms of illness, even for the E. coli outbreak and how to prevent the spread of disease, just using vinegar on your foods or other kinds of herbs. So there are a lot of approaches that we should be using and teaching to our families and children.
But I suppose in the sort of the political arena the suppression of information about and access to, or the misinformation put out about alternatives, to the extent that that continues to be effective in keeping the larger population from becoming aware of and accessing homeopathy and other alternatives, many people are looking to and rely on antibiotics. And
right.
You have bugs.
It's been called the miracle
problem.
Drug. Penicillin antibiotics have been called the miracle drug, but now they're failing. And so we have to look at things that are more universally used over generations and not over decades. And I think that's what we're going to have to go back. And a lot of people say, your grandmother's medicine is the best. And I think that's true. We're going to take a closer look at this. And I think we have, Victor has just given us another document to look at. And then we're going to close the show. It's called www.pharmalot.com, Pharmalot, with Ed Silverman. How can pharma use social media for real-time intelligence and research? There's going to be a show on Tuesday, the 21st. So he must like this. A Senate bill to unseal secret pharma documents. For all the intriguing evidence that emerges from product liability litigation about potential hazards of different medicines, still more documents are often kept under wraps. Why? And so he gives us that link, and we are really out of time today. We're going to end with your singing us out, and we're really going strong. We're going to look for next Thursday, a regular time show at noon, to continue this conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Thank you. allow our souls to shine. Listening for the great new love and hearing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your soul. What I want, we are changing the world. It takes an act of loving will to cause a change you be. So light your inner candle and ever guard its flame. And as its radiance grows brighter to the world it will proclaim. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by one we are free. Share your light, let your truth be unfurled. One by